Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arsalan Mohammed. And it's good to be back. It's been a year. It really has been a year since the last episode, which is a long time. But I hope you'll agree that when you hear this conversation that the wait has been worth it. Because joining me back at the virtual Wheels of Steel to spin another LP is the author of The Complete David Bowie, actor and occasional Dalek Nicholas Pegg, a veteran of Album to Album, and in this episode, he bravely rolls up his sleeves to go where no one else dares to go. That's right, we're heading back to the autumn of 1984. We're going to beware the savage jaw, and we're going to get in and down with Tonight. Now, while one could be ingenious and argue that Tonight was actually a cunning bit of conceptual art, satirizing the pressures of pop stardom, the prosaic truth is that, 40 years on, poor old Tonight really hasn't aged well. And over the years, a consensus has formed that writes it off more or less as an almighty floater, turned in by a bored and under-inspired Superman who's clearly having an off day. Because if you think about it, by mid-1984, after years of creative overdrive, middling sales, personal dramas by the bucket load, and then sudden global superstardom, perhaps David Bowie just needed a bit of time off? We don't have the sure touch of a Tony Visconti or the brooding presence of a Brian Eno. Here we have a so-so production, there's a distinct lack of Bowie originals, and an almost frightening ubiquity of marimba, and all of this leaves this album floundering in the shallows of 1984's pop pantheon. So Bowie was sent back into the studio with a young new producer, an industry veteran as engineer, a couple of new compositions, a marimba player. What happened next? Well, let's get stuck in right now and we'll find out in the first part of the Tonight Mega Chat.
I just recently played a judge in a forthcoming TV drama series about the life and times of Mahatma Gandhi. So that was something.
Really?
Yeah. Not, I'm not like, you know, it's not about the judge. The judge is in one scene, but it's a very good scene and a very good judge. But yeah, I think I'm in like episode 4 or something. But no, it's a big new thing being made by an Indian production company. And I think it's going to be 3 seasons. It's being touted as Asia's answer to The Crown. You know, it's a great big thing. Because this is season 1, this is indeed his early career. So I was playing a rather nasty, pompous, colonial, imperial judge in South Africa, where he started his career as a barrister. So yes, I'm no doubt one of many judges shouting him down and saying case dismissed. So that was fun. It was obviously, although set in South Africa, my scene was actually shot in Aylesbury. In the old courthouse there, they shot lots of hot lights on it to make it look like Africa, and I'm sure it did. And just round the corner from where the courthouse is, you know, Aylesbury Market Square.
Yes.
The old, you know, Aylesbury Friars, which has a certain cachet, of course, in the David Bowie history.
That was where Ziggy Stardust was unveiled.
It wasn't the very first Ziggy. Well, it depends on what you count as the first one. I mean, the first sort of Ziggy Stardust tour show proper was actually, I think, at the Toby Jug in Tolworth in early 72. But the famous Aylesbury one that people remember was a little before that. It was the tail end of 71 when the Ziggy Stardust album was sort of, on the starting blocks. And Bowie played a gig there, which, of course, had now been released. It was around on bootleg for a long time. But on the Divine Symmetry Hunky Dory box set that came out a while ago, it's on there. And it's the gig at which, legend has it, that at the end of the gig, Bowie was just sitting in the bar, kind of wiggling a bit and thinking, we're onto something here. It's about to happen. And he's quite excited. And then they did go back to Aylesbury, of course, during the early Ziggy tour as well. So it has a certain thing. And because there's a market square there, I think this is possibly a bit of a stretch, but some have suggested that, you know, pushing through the market square, the first line of the Ziggy Stardust album, of course, might have something to do with Aylesbury. But I think that might be a bit, you know, there's a market square in a Bob Dylan song. So, I mean, it's not as if, you know,
It's pushing it slightly. Well, from Ziggy Stardust to Mahatma Gandhi, Aylesbury certainly has its finger on the pulse.
Certainly does.
A culturally significant town. Let's move 12 years forward from Ziggy. Mm. Now, we were talking some time ago about reconvening, and you told me that you would very much like to talk about this album, an album which hasn't really had much love over the years. An album which is generally regarded alongside, say, Never Let Me Down as being pretty much the nadir of Bowie's career. Now, as ever, you have a point of view, which is always fascinating to hear. And marimbas, cover versions, not bad artwork, a strange lineup of collaborators. Let's talk about tonight.
EMI present the outstanding man of music, the one and only David Bowie, with his hit album, Tonight. Tonight features his current single, plus Blue Jean and seven other great new tracks. Get David Bowie at his best. Get David Bowie tonight.
Why did you want to talk about Tonight?
Well, I think perhaps for all of those reasons that you've just outlined, really, because, you know, we've said this before, you know, one of the first ones that I decided I wanted to talk about when we first did a podcast together quite some years ago now was the possibly even more notorious Never Let Me Down. Because, look, you know, we're big David Bowie appreciators, and I think there's something, whilst it's fantastic and interesting to talk about Ziggy Stardust and Heroes and all the great, you know, the ones that we can all agree are classics, I think there's also just something really interesting about looking at some of the ones that as you say, don't get much love and don't get much attention. And I'm not going to sit here and argue today that Tonight is David Bowie's undiscovered masterpiece. I don't think that's the case. But I do think there's a lot more about it, as we say in Nottingham, there where I grew up, than people might say. Because, you know, okay, it's a patchy album, but a patchy David Bowie album is still going to be 10 times more interesting than a lot of people's best work. And I do think it merits a bit of examination. And it does, you know, its best bits are actually really genuinely very good bits. It comes at a funny time in his career, of course. You know, this is the first album he made after, and in the very quick sort of aftermath of his greatest commercial strike of his career. So far, of course, Let's Dance, which had come out the previous year. And Let's Dance came out. The Serious Moonlight tour followed, which was the biggest rock tour, not only the biggest tour he'd ever done, but it was the biggest tour of 1983, you know, in the world. Mm. The statistics, when you look at them, are extraordinary. You know, there's a concert he played in Auckland in New Zealand, which at the time was the largest ever gathering of the citizens of New Zealand. Which is extraordinary. Now, I don't know whether that may have been surpassed by some other Madonna concert or something by now. I have no idea. But at the time, those were the sort of incredible statistics that were flying around. And of course, he'd been on the cover of Time magazine. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence had come out. He was at the top of his commercial game. And of course, with that comes a certain expectation that you're going to deliver some more. And of course, this is a tricky thing for when you're when you're an artist like David Bowie, if there is even another artist like David Bowie. It was a position he, I suppose, in a way might have found himself in the wake of Ziggy and Aladdin Sane maybe 10 years earlier, in the sense that he was flavor of the month. But this was on a global scale. And let's not forget, this was a number one album, Tonight. I mean, you know, on the back of his, you know, his commercial stock being so high, this went to number one in the UK. And it was a very successful album. It's an album that a lot of people bought. It had a big hit single off it, Blue Jean. You know, it went to number six in the charts, which is not bad. It might not be an album that people listen to very much these days, but, you know, for that little period of time in its day, it was a very successful album.
I mean, you talk about the tour, and I've read that it was the tour, which, as you say, was probably the biggest tour by anyone in 1983. So that must have been a singularly exhausting experience, you know, emotionally, physically, creatively. And from what I understand, EMI were eager for him to deliver the follow-up to Let's Dance in pretty short order.
Yes.
And he went off on holiday with Iggy and Coco and Iggy's partner. And his thought was, no, let's put out a live album. Let's do the Serious Moonlight live album.
There was indeed talk
and
of that.
EMI was saying, no, we need fresh product from you. Yeah. Pretty much now.
Yeah, exactly.
So he went into these sessions with not really a great amount of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And not really many songs.
I think that's right. He didn't, I think left to his own devices, he was not really, wasn't ready to do another album. But those were the pressures, as you say, on him. And as you also say, he went on holiday. The Serious Moonlight Tour ended in December 83. And pretty soon after that, off he went on holiday to Indonesia with Iggy Pop and his girlfriend. And they kind of hung out in all sorts of funny places. And this is germane because it's something that comes up in the album in a few different ways. Having been on that holiday and then returning to the West, pressure was on to produce some more material. And yeah, so work began on the album in they started recording in May of 84, so only about 5 months or so after the end of the Serious Moonlight Tour. So that is a pretty quick turnaround. It's interesting, isn't it, as well, the obvious thing to do, of course, would have been to go back to Nile Rodgers, who had produced the fantastically successful Let's Dance album. And that was a great sound. And Nile Rodgers was flavor of the month. But that's, of course, here we go. This is David Bowie, isn't it? That's not what he did. He immediately thought, well, I'm not going to. Now, I think that that's partly just David Bowie's restless creative spirit, wanting to not just repeat the success that he'd just had, or not repeat the formula that he'd just had to create that success. But also, I think there was a sense. I think he did feel a sense in which Nile Rodgers' contribution to Let's Dance, which was a fantastic contribution, but it had almost overshadowed David Bowie's own contribution to his own album. You know, it was almost a Nile Rodgers album rather than it was like 50-50. So I'm not saying that it was an ego thing, but I think Bowie needed to prove himself away from that no longer up and coming, but right up there producer.
Yeah.
So he goes for someone far less well-known instead, and approaches a guy called Derek Bramble, who had been the bass player with the band Heatwave, who had some big hits in the 70s, Always and Forever and Boogie Nights and those sort of things. And I think more recently he'd been working with David Grant, the singer from Lynx, who had that big hit around about this time, Intuition. So he was a great player and a embryonic producer, and that's who Bowie went to.
But we pause on the word embryonic, because this is something that's going to come back to haunt proceedings. Embryonic. Also, bear in mind, I think Derek Bramble was 22.
Yeah,
at the time. Yeah. I mean, he was amazingly young, and he hadn't done, you know, I don't think he'd worked with an artist of this stature before.
Right.
Interestingly, he had worked with Jackie Graham.
That's right. Yeah.
He'd worked with Jackie Graham, and he felt that Bowie had somehow heard some demos he'd produced of Jackie Graham's, which is what piqued his interest. But then I've also heard that it was actually Bernard Doherty, his PR, who had said, oh, you must work with this guy. I don't know.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. That's interesting. No, that's entirely possible.
Information is quite scant on Mr. Bramble.
On quite exactly how this meeting of mine happened.
How this happened. But yeah. Derek Bramble himself had said that when he came into the project, he was saying, I didn't really know much about David Bowie. I wasn't really that aware of him. I knew who he was, but I can say I was a big fan.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was quite casual about it. There's an interview with him from, I think, the late 80s, somewhere online, where he's talking about that process. And yeah, he's, you know, pretty much it was okay. It was more like, I'm offered a huge gig, I'm not going to turn it down.
Yes, no, it's so very interesting. So he comes in, and Bowie, I believe, was hoping that it would be engineered by Bob Clearmountain, who worked on Let's Dance, but he was busy on something else. So he recommended the next key member of our team and the next new arrival, someone who hadn't worked with David Bowie, and actually already at this time a far more established person, who was invited to come in and engineer, not produce. This is Hugh Padgham, who by this stage was a very established producer. He'd been working with all sorts of people, XTC, Genesis, Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins in their solo thing. Great bit of Hugh Padgham trivia. You know, on Games Without Frontiers by Peter Gabriel?
Yes.
Apparently it's the Padge doing the whistling.
Is that the Padge?
That's the Padge doing that whistling.
Nick, can I give you another piece of Padge trivia?
Please do. Padge away.
Do you know who Hugh Padgham's married to?
I don't actually know.
Kath Kidston.
Oh, really?
Yes. There you go.
Well, there we
That's
go.
A bit of Padge trivia
this
for
is,
you.
This is turning into a very educational podcast, isn't it? So, and of course, Hugh Padgham, among his many achievements, he is generally recognized as the begetter and creator of the famous gated reverb drum sound that Phil Collins made so famous on In the Air Tonight, and was one of the sounds of the 1980s, wasn't it? For better or worse. Often for better, sometimes for worse.
A drum exploding inside a house brick.
It is like a controlled explosion, isn't it? Because it's a quite sort of dry sound. Is that right? You know, it's quite sort of, it sounds quite almost sort of boxy rather than roomy. It has reverb, but then the reverb just sort of stops in some way. I'm not describing it very well, am I? He possibly had his greatest successes so far with The Police. And as you say, at that stage in their career, a pretty tricky proposition in the studio by all accounts, because there were days when people weren't even looking at each other, let alone talking to each other.
So he must have been kicking back after that, thinking, gosh, now for a nice,
straightforward, we'll go and work with the grown-ups. We won't have any of that nonsense. And what happens? Well, we shall come to it. But of course, you know, out of that very, very hot situation in the studio with The Police came some of their most famous work. So he was a big name. So it's interesting, isn't it, that the fact that he accepted going in on the Bowie album as an engineer was entirely because, whilst Derek Bramble might have been a bit blasé, Hugh Padgham took a demotion to work with the great David Bowie. He thought, I couldn't turn that down, could I? Even though he felt a bit iffy about going in as a mere engineer rather than as the head honcho. So we're already setting up a slightly peculiar situation in the studio. We've got the big star. We've got a really, really well-established producer who's at the top of his game and winning awards as the engineer. And then we've got this really quite untried and tested, apparently by all accounts, very nice man and good musician, Derek Bramble, who is in the kind of top seat. So that's a peculiar situation in the studio. And just to sort of add another level of unfamiliarity to the proceedings, where are we recording? Well, uniquely...
Hang on, let me guess where we're recording this. We're recording this in the heart of London. Maybe we're in the middle of New York, bustling, energetic.
No.
Maybe we're in LA.
We're not even in LA. No. It was the Padge who suggested this studio. He'd worked there. I think he may have worked there with The Police at one point, but he's certainly been working there with various people. Yeah. This is the only David Bowie studio album to have been recorded in Canada. So we're at the marvellously named studio, Le Studio, which is just a side...
They really thought a long time about that one, didn't they?
Stayed up all night on that one, didn't they? Yeah. So it's Le Studio just outside Montreal. You know, not that that's sort of the back of Beyond or something, but it's not home turf, is it? It's an internet, but it was a studio that was, you know, largely because of Hugh Padgham's work, actually, but various people. It was a place that people were going to record at that time. So we're in Canada, and it's 1984, and this is the setup. And when we think of David Bowie albums, there's often a kind of defining guest star or contributor who helped to give that album its musical identity. You know, you might think of Robert Fripp on Scary Monsters or Heroes, or Mike Garson on Aladdin Sane, or Rick Wakeman on Hunky Dory, or Stevie Ray Vaughan, of course, on the most recent album, Let's Dance. But Tonight, which I think is quite interesting, it's an album that doesn't have a sort of obvious star turn. You know, it doesn't have a big name lead guitarist or a virtuoso pianist. It's got a wonderful guitarist. Of course, it has the wonderful Carlos Alomar, but Carlos would often play sort of, you know, second guitar to some sort of big soloist who came in. And on this occasion, not so. In fact, this is really interesting as well. I've mentioned keyboards. Derek Bramble, as well as playing some bass on the album, plays a few synth lines here and there, but not many. And other than that, Tonight is an album that has no credited keyboard player at all, apart from Derek Bramble playing a few synths. But what does it have instead? You've already mentioned it. It has marimbas. This is actually a really significant part of this album's identity, I think. You know, if for some reason, the marimba is an instrument that always makes people chuckle, and it's understandable. There is a slight weird, it's almost, in some contexts, it's almost a sort of comedy instrument because it's associated with sort of cartoon music and things. You know, it's the sort of instrument that you might play a sort of sort of music on. But it's also it's a very beautiful instrument. It's a cousin of the xylophone. It's a percussion instrument, but effectively like a xylophone, laid out like a keyboard, like a piano keyboard, with individually tuned wooden bars that are struck with mallets. It's got a slightly lower range than the xylophone, so it's got a slightly sort of mellower sound. But it is a percussion instrument. So unlike a keyboard, it doesn't have, you can't sustain notes. You can't really get reverb unless you do it in, post-production or whatever. It's an instrument associated with Latin music.
Yeah.
But also, and now we're going back to Indonesia and Asia with David, it does bring to mind, to me at least, that scene in the Ricochet film, that was shot at in the closing stages of the series Moonlight Tour, where David sits cross-legged, rapt with attention, listening to a gamelan orchestra playing in Bangkok, and they're not exactly marimbas, but they're playing sort of plinky plonky percussion instruments.
I remember,
you can almost see David going bing. And of course, marimbas were having a bit of a moment in pop music at this point. Anyway, they are a very 1984 instrument. I know they'd been in pop. There's a famous marimba in the Rolling Stones song "Under My Thumb" back in the 60s. I think Brian Jones actually played it himself, didn't he? And then Benny from ABBA famously plays a marimba at the beginning of Mamma Mia. For some reason, it's kind of caught on in pop music around about 82, 83. There's a big marimba solo in Africa by Toto, which is one of those great big hits of the time. And Depeche Mode used a marimba on Everything Counts. Thompson Twins were marimba crazy. Hold Me Now, which had been a big hit at the Christmas 83. Yeah, Hold Me Now, You Take Me Up on the same album. That's a steeped in marimba. So it's 1984 and it's David Bowie's marimba moment. And the marimba contribution, incidentally, comes from someone who was local to Le Studio, a French-Canadian multi-instrumentalist and songwriter called Guy Saint-Ange. Local, he was based in Montreal. He did albums of his own. He had already worked, I think, quite a lot with the not yet terribly famous Celine Dion, another Canadian, of course, and worked on all of her albums and things. But so in he came to play the marimba, and it's there. It's on Loving the Alien. It's on Blue Jean. It's on very much on Tonight, the song Tonight.
Yes.
has a marimba solo halfway through, and and so it is almost the equivalent of something like Mike Garson on Aladdin Sane. Guy Saint-Ange on marimba is the sort of unique sound of the Tonight album, and I do actually think it's a rather lovely sound.
I think for me it's definitely something that he's proved his point about the marimba very emphatically on this album. I mean, there's an awful lot of marimba on the album. I find its ubiquity somewhat symptomatic of a deeper issue with this album, in the sense that this album is really not an album where Bowie is setting the pace and is creating something exciting and new, but is sort of in the slipstream of what happens to be in the air at that time.
Absolutely right. And then, of course, this is one of the things that is very observable about this album is that, it's not an album in which it doesn't feel like a pioneering album. It feels like an album that is in step with the times, but not a step ahead of the times, which is what Bowie was accustomed to being.
Let's just have a brief pause to look at September 1984.
Mm-hmm. So this is the release date of the album.
This is, broadly speaking, release date was September 24th. On which date Paul McCartney released No More Lonely Nights, great song. The week before, Bowie had actually won Best Video at MTV Awards for China Girl. So, as you said earlier, his star was very much in the ascendant around the time that Tonight came out. Loads of pre-orders. Anticipation was high for Let's Dance Part 2. Tina Turner was number one with What's Love Got to Do With It. So we will be coming to Tina.
We will.
But she was also somebody who was very much having that moment. In September 84. What else happened? Oh, yeah. This is a big cultural moment. CBS premiered Murder, She Wrote, starring Angela Lansbury in September 84. And a moment of great global history was being made as Britain and China initialed the agreement to return Hong Kong to China. And number one at the end of September 1984 was Let's Go Crazy by Prince. And Prince, of course, is the person that we can see as sort of almost stepping into Bowie's shoes.
Absolutely.
Around that time.
Yeah.
As an innovator, as a genuinely exciting one-off talent,
very
a
much
complete
so.
Genius.
Yeah.
So I think that's quite interesting that, as Tonight comes out, Prince is number one. But yes, so scene is set.
The scene is set. So, yes, and as you mentioned earlier on, he hasn't got a whole load of new material. He's got a bit of new material. What he has got is his old and dear friend Iggy Pop in the studio with him during the sessions. And another old familiar face, as we mentioned earlier on, is Carlos Alomar, of course, on guitar, who had been on the tour but hadn't actually played on the Let's Dance album. Alone among the run of albums that Carlos played on, that was the one he wasn't on. Well, I asked Carlos about this a while back, and because I thought, maybe it's just because, you know, effectively you can see that Nile Rodgers would fulfill that role because he's a guitarist himself and was very hands-on with the thing. Carlos said, well, it wasn't so much that. It was just that Bowie had just signed up with EMI and finally extricated himself from some of the contractual problems that he'd had before, you know, his management situation that had taken him a long time to disentangle himself from in the 1970s. And basically not to beat about the bush, Carlos was accustomed to asking for a little raise each time for an album session and would be granted it. In the case of the Let's Dance sessions, Bowie's new sort of hirers and firers weren't having any of that, and in fact offered him slightly less than usual. And he said, well, sorry guys, but I'm quite busy actually, so that'll be a no. And off he went. And of course, once it came to the tour, Bowie absolutely insisted on having him, because they were good friends, and Carlos is a mightily brilliant musician and was the band leader on that tour. And then of course he's back in the team after that. So that's good. And Carlos's wife, Robin Clark, of course, also at this point riding high with her work with Simple Minds, who she was touring with, is also along for the tonight session. So those are some familiar faces. And also kept on from the tour or from the Let's Dance album, we've got Carmine Rojas on bass and Omar Hakim on drums, George Sims on backing vocals, the Borneo horns, of course, the saxophone section. So quite a lot of the Let's Dance personnel, along with these new faces, a few other people, a guy called Mark Pender on trumpet and flugelhorn, a lot of trumpets on this album, which is again a very sort of early to mid-80s pop thing. Yes. You know, one thinks of, you know, Wham and Kid Creole and the Coconuts. Everyone's doing trumpets, aren't they? Now, let's not compare this album to Kid Creole and the Coconuts. I think we can go
a
bit better than that. But anyway, but yeah, this sort of thing. And we also haven't mentioned, another legendary figure who, making his debut with Bowie at this point, is Arif Mardan, who's an arranger and producer who had worked with everybody, you know, Bee Gees, Aretha Franklin, Carly Simon. He'd worked with the best.
And he was the arranger who basically galvanized the Bee Gees into the disco phase of their career.
That's right.
Isn't he?
That's right. And in fact, Arif Mardan is credited with discovering, as it were, Barry Gibb's amazing falsetto, which didn't used to be a thing that the Bee Gees did. And then suddenly, around about 1975, it's the sound of the Bee Gees. And it was Arif Mardan who went, oh, that's good. Do more of that. No, right. Yeah. Now do the whole song like that. And suddenly that became, you know, what the Bee Gees sounded like.
So he was a bit of a legend.
He was a bit of a legend. And round about the time of the Tonight Sessions, he was also producing Chaka Khan's version of the Prince song, I Feel For You, which is an extraordinary piece of production. And that went on to become a monster hit, of course, later on in...
Arif Mardan produced
that. He did indeed. Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Because, of course, amazing track.
Prince recorded the original version, which I think he produced it himself, I assume. I think he did. But yeah, Arif Mardan produced, and that's an extraordinary piece of production. That's got the kitchen sink and Stevie Wonder and everything. and that became a huge hit round about the time that Tonight and Blue Jeans single came out. You know, it was all happening in the autumn of 84. So Arif Mardan did the string arrangements, basically, for Tonight. Specifically, and most obviously on Loving the Alien. I mean, that is an epic string arrangement, whatever else is on there. And he went on to work with Bowie again. He worked with him on the soundtrack songs for Labyrinth. A year or so later. So he's
wondering how it would have been had Arif Mardan been the producer.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an interesting conjecture, isn't it? Because he's quite a sort of chameleonic producer, I think. You know, he would sort of go to the act and draw out whatever was best in them, rather than, there wasn't an Arif Mardan sound in the way that there's a Phil Spector sound or a Nile Rodgers sound, I don't think, anyway. That is an interesting thing to conjecture, isn't it? Yeah.
He could have taken the raw elements that we had going into Tonight and maybe done something really exciting with them. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And you also mentioned Iggy. So, like, Iggy had been very, very close with David, especially in the last few years.
Yeah.
There is this funny, tragicomic sort of narrative with Iggy, in the sense that, you know, his own career was stopping and starting and sputtering and going into crazy places again. I read somewhere that in 1982, Iggy and his then-girlfriend Esther Friedman had gone to Haiti on holiday. It was just an absolute bizarre, surreal experience where Pop antagonized a local voodoo priest by dancing during a ceremony. The pair lost all of their money, Pop giving it most away to locals. This forced Friedman to work as a back-alley dentist assistant. They were nearly killed in a car crash. Menacing strangers kept showing up at their house. Friedman tried several times to get a by now ailing Pop off the island, with the pair failing to catch their flight in increasingly strange ways.
Oh dear.
That's according to Chris O'Leary.
Right, right.
So just to give some background, this is where Iggy Pop was at the moment. And now poor old Iggy had had numerous run-ins with the IRS, numerous tax problems. Shortly after that bonkers visit to Haiti, he got his royalties coming in for China Girl, which obviously went a long way to ameliorate his situation. But part of the conversations we assumed that were going on when the pair went off on their holiday after Serious Moonlight were around doing an album together. And there's this deep, quite dire financial need on the side of Iggy. There's a dearth of fresh material from Bowie. And so it makes sense for Bowie, who was always extremely generous and kind and supportive of his friend, to basically say, right, well, here's what we can do. And I feel this is a relationship where, like any relationship between two people who are very, very close, over time, the dynamic shifts. So one is supporting the other, then one is supporting the other. And everything I've been reading over the last few days about tonight, it seemed very much like Iggy was here for David at this point. It wasn't just a case of David saying, right, I'll just do a few songs and that's it. Here's a check. Yeah. But the dynamic between them, as we'll find out as we go through the whole recording process, was very much like Iggy being a support for David, who was pretty much all at sea, really, in terms of what he was doing and who he was and what he wants to do.
I think you're absolutely right about that. It's exactly that. I mean, yes, Bowie had the sort of commercial power of patronage, as it were. He could deliver a hit album which would generate some much needed songwriting royalties for Iggy Pop. So that was an act of great generosity. But what he was getting in return was that, yes, he hadn't really got a whole lot of new material, and Iggy was his kind of creative sounding board and indeed collaborator on this album. There aren't just some old covers of some old Iggy Pop songs, although there are. There are also some new collaborations, which were quite Iggy-led, I think, in the writing and in the improvising. So,
very eccentric.
But we begin the album, of course, with one of the two Bowie originals. And in most estimations, these two tracks are the sort of standouts of the album. But you know, this is a matter of opinion, of course. And it's quite a long one. It's also 7 minutes long or something on the album. Yeah, Loving the Age. I think by any standard is a very, very fine piece of songwriting and one of Bowie's best songs of the period. Whether it's one of the best delivered songs of the period in the recording and on the album, well, this is a slightly different matter. Although, you know, when I sat down to listen to this album again in preparation for this conversation, I have to say, you know, maybe I'm just getting soft in my old age, but I sat there thinking, this is great. I love this. It sounds wonderful. I have to say the remastering on the Loving Alien box set, the 1980s box set that came out a few years ago, I think the work on Tonight is one of the unsung triumphs of that project. It sounds beautiful. And I think Loving Alien is a beautiful song. We've got a lot going on in this song. It's a substantial piece of songwriting. It's not a throwaway.
No, it's a very substantial piece of songwriting, and in its lyric and the themes and the themes he's exploring, you know, we could be reminded of something like Word on a Wing or any one of those songs over the last decade or so where faith, religion, the value of religion, his own struggles with belief and so on come under the microscope. And it is an amazingly profound lyric. Eerily resonant at the moment.
It really is. And so, you know, obviously, the first entry-level thing to say about this song is it's not about aliens. The inattentive hear the song, hear the title, and go, "Oh, it's something to do with spacemen again." He's always on about that, isn't he? But no, yes, this is as you say, a song about the
in um, Yeah, in 2000, and this is something I found at the perennially wonderful Bowie Bible. Somebody asked him, Q Magazine did a Q&A with Bowie, and they asked readers to send in questions. So Brian in Tamworth wrote to Bowie, and imagine this is your chance to put something to David Bowie. What would you ask him? How does one love aliens?
Uh-oh.
And the reply came, any twat who thought the song was about little green men would definitely have a problem with the concept. But for those perceptive souls, preferably from outside of Tamworth, it would be clear that the subject of the song revolved around the ongoing holy wars between Christianity and Islam. And to answer the question by example, we got love in my household.
Wow. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's told Brian from Tamworth.
Someone got out the wrong side of bed that day, didn't they? But no, well, Brian from Tamworth, that's you told, isn't it? No, yeah, well, exactly. And quite right, too, because it's not about, you know, and obviously the word alien doesn't just mean that thing from that Ridley Scott film. Yes. It does actually mean, foreigner, doesn't it? And so, of course, this is a song about David Bowie's increasingly complex relationship with, well, not just with God or with gods, but with the whole idea of what religion is and whether it's, he was always very suspicious of and disenchanted with the shortcomings and abuses inherent in any kind of organized religion. And this is a song about that. It's also a song about the possibility of harmony between people of different faiths and people of no faith, and specifically Christianity and Islam. In the chorus, or the lead up to the chorus, a very important word turns up, which will be reappearing in Bowie's career in later years. If you pray, all your sins are hooked upon the sky, pray and the heathen lie will disappear. Yeah, I mean, I've got a little quote here. Bowie said at the time, in 84, when talking about the album, he said that Loving Alien was, here's the quote, the most personalized bit of writing on the album for me. Not to say that the others were written from a distance, but they're a lot lighter in tone. This one was me in there dwelling on the idea of the awful shit we've had to put up with because of the church. That's how it started out. For some reason, I was very angry. And then he went on to say it came about because of the feeling that so much history is wrong, as is being rediscovered all the time, and that we base so much on the wrong knowledge that we've gleaned. It's extraordinary considering all the mistranslations in the Bible, that our lives are being navigated by this misinformation and that so many people have died because of it. So, this is not a fluff piece, a fluffy song.
It's even within the context of this overall, generally disappointing album, here we have themes that have been coming up time and time again and would come up time and time again. So even in Let's Dance before, we would have had Modern Love, God and Man, No Religion.
Yeah, yeah.
Where there's a brief allusion to this. Obviously, in the Heathen album, these themes get explored deeper, but it does come back to interrogating the integrity of a doctrine.
Yes.
And interrogating people's motives as a result of, dubious doctrines or dubious interpretations of doctrines. And that's really a theme throughout
Bowie's
really
is. It really is. And the chorus, it's just sort of two lines, the actual chorus of the song, and it's monumental. You've just to sit down and think about what he's saying. Prayers, they hide the saddest view. Believing the strangest things, loving the alien. There's so much in that. There's so much in that. And as with ever with Bowie, it means what it needs to mean to the listener. But prayers, they hide the saddest. It's a great lyric. Yeah.
Fantastic lyric. And again, it's a song that clearly had a lot of resonance for him. And I think it's probably that interview that you just quoted from, I think, which was around the Tim Machine period. He was reflecting back on Tonight and Never Let Me Down, and he cites this song. And he's saying, there's stuff on those albums that I could really kick myself about. I mean, you should hear the demo of Loving the Alien. It's fantastic. And it's lovely because he's still really, really passionate about this song that clearly holds a lot of meaning for him. But of course, once in the studio, it got,
I mean, I don't think it sounds horrible. I think it sounds, I think it sounds very sort of proficient. If that's what a dabbing it with faint praise. Ooh, it's very proficient. But no, it is beautifully played, but it just hadn't. There's an edge missing, isn't there? There's definitely
an edge missing. And I think I mentioned this to you the other day, but for some reason when I was listening to it, I kept thinking of It's No Game, Part 2. Maybe it's the sort of loping feel of it. Maybe it's in a certain key or something, but it certainly had a feel of that. And it just made me wish for a Visconti at the helm that could have done something different with this song.
One of the great things about Tony Visconti, as with, and other very good producers, is knowing when to stock, knowing when to declutter. And this is a cluttered production, yeah. I think. Yeah. This is a thing across the album, actually. They've thrown the kitchen sink at it, but not necessarily in a good way. There's too much going on. There's probably enough. The video of Loving the Alien, which we haven't talked about yet, it is almost the same. It's spectacular. There's all sorts of things going on, but there's almost too much going on. One minute he's on fire, and then he's a crusader, and then he's standing in a wasteland with a bride, and it's crazy. It's very much a video for the MTV age, but it's all over the place. It doesn't have that sort of pared down.
I don't think there's very much pared down in total.
There isn't.
Whole period.
No, absolutely. So that's the, and let me say again, I do really like this song. I really, really like it. I wish that the recording and the production were a little bit more edgier and a little bit sharper, but I still do rather love it. And of course, as we know, it's a song that he did return to live in his career. He played it as per the album on the Glass Spider tour, pretty much there's the same kind of arrangement and a great routine in it as well, with his crazy dances on the Glass Spider tour, playing a sort of blind pilgrim and doing some of his old sort of mime stuff from the 1960s, the Lindsay Kemp sort of albatross flying sort of mime and covering his eyes and it was a very effective routine. But then many, many years later, on the reality tour 2003-04, and initially, I think, at the Tibet House Benefit concert just before that, he reimagined the song with Jerry Leonard on guitar, and it was just Jerry Leonard on guitar and some pedals
that
and some
lovely,
strange echoey noises, and it was very pared down, and that was a lovely version. I do actually still really like the big band version. I say I like both. Just hearing it as pared down, and it's just the words, and it's just that little riff, and that it became a very different, still a very powerful piece.
In terms of the album performance, have a listen to this and see what you think. So yeah, do you see that as well? Do you hear that?
I think that is quite noticeable, isn't it? Yes, it is.
It's very eerie, isn't it? Because it is almost like Carlos is playing, almost doing an homage to Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah,
there.
It is. It is very, very interesting. I mean, I don't know, was it even conscious? Maybe it was, or maybe it was just. I find it hard to believe that David sat down in the studio and played them China Girl and said, do a bit that sounds like that, because that's so counter to the way he would want anything to be. But somehow or other, I mean, let's not forget, of course, Carlos had played on China Girl on a daily basis for months on end the previous year on tour. So maybe it just kind of rubbed off on this.
Maybe a bit of that. The muscle memory was coming back.
Yeah. But it is funny, isn't it? And of course, you do get these echoes all the time in Bowie's work. But that is a very recent echo, isn't it?
Yes.
And there are other things, another little thing in this song, because he's always, pulling bits from here and there, isn't he? Those sort of rhythmic backing vocals, or whatever, vocals you want to think. Yes, he borrowed that from Philip Glass, another favorite of his and erstwhile collaborator as well. Einstein on the Beach does sound a little bit like Laurie Anderson's
Superman.
Anderson, as well.
Exactly.
And again, Oh Superman, a song which he went on to cover live on stage in the 90s. Mentioning the video again for a moment, one of the many bizarre images in the video is Bowie with a light bulb in his mouth, a lit light bulb. And that, again, that's straight out of Laurie Anderson's Oh Superman video. Is it a reference, or is it just a sort of, that's fun, let's do that. So it is, it's eclectic as ever, fascinating as ever, in terms of its grapple with increasingly complicated relationship with religion and spirituality. For all its faults, it is one of his genuinely substantial contributions to his own oeuvre in the 1980s. And I think it's a song that's worth, you know, worth another look. Interestingly, it was not a song that he regarded as one, an obvious single to come straight out of the stable. Mm. It was the third single from the album. And it didn't come out until 8 months after the album was released. It came out quite belatedly in May 85, so a year after it was recorded. And it didn't do incredibly well either. It did okay, but it only went to number 19.
Do you think this was really the record label maybe had rejected it as a lead-off single? I mean, that's crazy when you think about it now, isn't it? A major artist puts out an album and then, you know, 6 months down the line, is putting out a single.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just peculiar, isn't it? I mean, the first thing, we'll get to it, but the first single, of course, is Blue Jean. I can get that. It's the obvious hit, and indeed it was a hit. So that's it. But then the next single he released was Tonight, the title track. And then it went quiet for a bit. Tonight, and again, we'll come to this, but Tonight really did bomb. It didn't have a video, the single. It didn't have a video, and it only got to number 53.
Did it not have a video?
No, there's no video of. I mean, latterly, people see that video of Bowie and Tina Turner performing it on stage.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
of,
but that was in 1985. That was later on. No. You know, it was a few months later. So that
wasn't the official.
Yeah. Video. Slightly odd one, isn't it? That possibly because he just come off the back of making the most elaborate video he'd made yet, you know, the Blue Jean video, which again we'll come to. Possibly it was that, or possibly it was just because he couldn't be bothered. But no, there was no video for Tonight, and it absolutely bombed. And goes to show, doesn't it, that the videos at this stage in the evolution of the music industry were really important. Blue Jean went to number 6. The follow-up single went to number 53, and I don't think it even charted in America.
And obviously, MTV been going what, 1 year, 2 years?
A couple of years now.
So videos were very much where it was at, and I think this was around the time that Michael Jackson had done a mini movie for Thriller. There were huge record company budgets. People were having a lot of fun with videos.
Of course, videos
really resonated. There's, you know, plenty of television outlets for videos right now. So, you know, to do a video would be the first thing you would think of. And it's astonishing to think of Bowie not really engaging with that beyond Blue Jean.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's a really odd little moment. Yeah. I don't know what, you know, maybe the Blue Jean video costs so much that EMI said, no, that's your budget. But then he comes back, you know, as I said, a few months later, quite sort of belatedly, comes this, you know, this Johnny Come Lately single, Loving the Alien, remixed heavily, of course, because it's you know, a sort of single length and quite heavily remixed. The single version is actually a little bit punchier than the album version. I think it's not, it has a slightly, it cuts through slightly more and is shorter. But apparently Bowie had just read in some review or something somewhere saying, oh, Loving the Alien would be a good single. And he went, oh, okay. And it was almost like an afterthought. Maybe in David's headspace, it wasn't a single. Yeah. It was just, you know, it was an album track. It was an important, you know, it was a sort of station to station song that you couldn't possibly think is a single. And maybe that's what he sort of thought. But anyway, it came out, as I say, in May 85. Not long before Live Aid. And of course, that's another little thing to say about Loving the Alien. Mm. Many and various have been the myths and conjectures over the years about what was the mythical song that David Bowie dropped at Live Aid. Kevin Armstrong, who played lead guitar for David at Live Aid, of course, assures me that the song that was dropped was Loving the Alien. So apparently that is what he was going to, which of course at the time was his, well, not exactly his new single, it's his 2-month-old single. But that's what they were going to play until David decided to drop a song in order to play the famous Appeal video.
It's funny. Yeah. I had heard it was Fascination.
Yep, I'd heard that, and I'd heard that it was 5 years. Yeah. I'd heard it was all sorts of crazy ones. And those may well have been songs that were rehearsed, because they did rehearse a whole load of songs and then cut it down to the selection. And then at the last minute, when David very generously said to Bob Geldof, you've got to play this video, Cars, you know, drive with the footage, he volunteered to cut a song from his set. And that was the one.
Moving on, we go to the first of our Iggy covers.
Yes.
And venture into the exciting world of white reggae.
Totally unexpected world of white reggae.
The totally unexpected world of white reggae.
Empty battlefield, but when I What is happening? So we've had this kind of epic sweeping Arif Mardan string arrangement,
yes.
A Bowie sort of widescreen song. And now we're taking a sort of new wave Iggy Pop song from his 1979 album New Values, and we're going reggae on it. Have you know the Iggy Pop original version?
I do. They're making sort of crazy sounds. So why be bored? Who scared you? And why stay there? It's no piece of cake. When I hear that crazy sound, I don't look down.
It's actually got quite glossy production of its own. It's quite new wavy. It's quite expansive, but it doesn't sound anything like this.
No, I love the guitars. I think it's Ricky Gardner who's played guitar.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And some spangly synth noises in a very sort of new wavy sort of almost Talking Heads way or something like that. It's a nice piece of production. But yeah, apparently Bowie had, of course, dabbled in white reggae kind of once before, about 5 years earlier, with Yassassin on Lodger. And at the time, I think he'd said, oh, I won't do that again. That was just an experiment.
Yeah. Right.
Well, here he is doing it again. And apparently it was an accident with a drum machine. That's what Bowie blamed it on at the time. He said he was fiddling around with a drum machine, trying to find a beat that he liked. And he accidentally pressed the button marked Scar or something, you know, and then listened to it. Well, obviously not that. And then thought, no, wait a minute, hang on. This is kind of recontextualizing this song in a strange new way that I actually rather like. So he went with it.
It was an accident with a drum machine.
It was an accident with a drum machine.
It wasn't my fault.
Wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Drum machine went crazy. Couldn't do anything about it.
But, you know, the result is decidedly peculiar. But actually, I rather like it. And I think it's rather lovely. It's an Iggy song about, well, as I understand it, is a song about feeling disoriented in the big city. I've never quite got what this lyric is really about, and we'll have to ask Iggy one of these days. But it's a very American song, of course. It makes reference to both Los Angeles and New York. There's a line about visiting Rudolph Valentino's grave, which is in Hollywood, but it's New York that keeps getting mentioned in Central Park. And Bowie always seemed to enjoy singing about New York, didn't he? I mean, obviously it was a city that he had a great affinity for, but there's a lot of Bowie lyrics that mention New York, you know, Gene Genie and what the song.
New York had a great elusive property for him.
Yeah,
it had a great elusive value for him. It could immediately, you know, as a kind of verbal shorthand. Again, this interesting Hugh Padgham connection there, because of course Hugh Padgham comes from, you know, the king of white reggae, Sting.
Yes, of course,
with his very unique phrasing, let's say. And here Bowie is affecting a slight patois, from Central Park to Shanty Town refrain. Winds its way through this song.
Do you know, what an idiot. It had never occurred to me, the Sting connection, the Padge Sting reggae.
The Padge Sting reggae.
You're absolutely right. Because I'd thought, you know, obviously I'd been thinking of it because Derek Bramble, who is the bassist on this track, certainly, he was helping Bowie with that. So once Bowie decided he wanted to go reggae, he went to Derek Bramble and said, can you play me? And he did. He's very good at this sort of thing. And it does have, that's one of the things I like about this track. It does have a very minimal, the opposite of what we were saying about Loving the Alien, actually. This is quite a stripped down track. And it does have a very nice, very laid back, lolloping, spare bass line, which is quite authentic, I think. But then, as you say, over the top, not the most authentic thing you've ever heard, is David doing his Sting voice. Yes. Yeah.
This, I think, is a wonderful example of Derek Bramble playing to his strengths. I mean, I think he's playing a six-string bass here and doing this fantastically, slightly skanking bass line, which is really nimble. It's kind of got a lovely groove to it. I think there's Carlos Alomar got very excited about this one. He said, I swear, man, you've never heard a better reggae song. For him to do a song like that, listen to his vocals. I mean, I think that's slightly over-egging it, but at the same time, because I have, as a matter of fact, heard better reggae songs than this. But let's just take a step back. And so we're talking about white reggae. And of course, Sting got a lot of flack for his cod Jamaican accent in some of his singing. But around that time, it wasn't unknown for major white artists to be doing reggae. I mean, reggae, Elvis Costello, Watching the Detectives, that was reggae. The Clash were doing Bank Robber.
Right.
UB40.
UB40, good heavens. UB40, I mean, Ali Campbell of UB40 basically just sort of impersonated a Jamaican, didn't he? I mean, that's exactly what he sort of did.
And then probably the greatest white reggae track of all time, Sea Moon by Paul McCartney, has come out.
Oh, yes.
Probably the absolute debts. So Bowie wasn't treading uncharted territory here. But again, like you said, he had dabbled in the form with The Assassin and then had pretty much left it alone. And, you know, it was kind of like that burst of white stars doing reggae was kind of on the way out at this point, wasn't it?
I think it kind of was, wasn't it? But you know, UB40 carried on doing
Well, they carried on. You know, like the Ford Sierra of the pop.
But no, you're right. I think this is an odd little moment. But you know, it is again, you know, we can't get away. This is part of the rather scattered identity of this album as well. We've talked a lot about the marimbas. We haven't really, you know, there's no marimbas. I don't think there's any marimba on this track. There's a lot of marimbas on Loving the Alien. Loving the Alien, there's the marimba going all of a sudden. Yeah. But no, I don't think it's on this. But another part of the identity of this album is this kind of dipping into reggae, because it's coming up again a couple of tracks later. Yes, it's an odd one, isn't it? I mean, one of the things that Bowie said about this album not long after it came out, because he was quite quick to not disown, because I don't think he disowned any of his work, but disparage perhaps this album a bit. He said he didn't think it held together as an album. So if you listen to one song or another song, it can sound quite good. But if you listen to the whole album, like we've just been saying, you know, one minute it's a great big epic like Loving the Alien. Next minute it's a strange kind of pared down reggae song. And then there's a, you know, sludgy cover version coming up next, which we'll get to in a minute. So it's a bit all over the place. But yes, but this sort of white reggae thing is part of this album's shtick. I don't think it's completely unsuccessful. It's not what I normally would look for in my in my David Bowie.
There are some tracks I still find very hard on this album to listen to, because I think they're just so awful. But this is, you know, and it's a very unfair thing to say. We look at an artist's career in totality, and they're going to be missteps. They're going to be bridges between one thing and the next thing. And we've talked about this at length when we've done our 1980s episodes. You can't, you know, I don't think anyone is blaming David Bowie for turning in a poor quality album, but it's more fascinating, really, to look at this man who's had a more or less uninterrupted run of inspiration over the last 11, 12 years, reaching the end of one point and just being in a position where I just don't have anything else in the tank is empty.
Yes.
You know, what's happening, looking around, where he had that uncanny ability to just about tap into what was going to happen next week.
Yes.
I like to think in previous albums. Here, it seems to be far more reactive. And this white reggae is symptomatic of that. Like we say about marimbas, marimbas were everywhere. You know, the white reggae was kind of on the way out now. Everyone had done that. And here he comes in thinking, right, I'm going to take Iggy's, these tunes of Iggy's, and I'm going to give them a twist, and I'm going to reggaeify them.
Yeah,
that's what's going to do. But really, at the end of the day, it's like, will this do? That's what I sense from this.
There is a sense, I'm afraid. You know, I do agree with you. There is a sense of sort of throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. And, and it's a, it doesn't hang together as an album coherently as a set of tracks in the way that Let's Dance does, or indeed in the way that Never Let Me Down does. I mean, for better or whether you like it or not, that is coherent album, I think. This is an incoherent album. Its incoherence is actually part of its identity in a way. And you know, and because I love everything, I'm accentuating the positive, and I quite like the fact that this album is a crazy mixed up kid, you know, but that doesn't mean that it's all wonderful. And it's a bit shambolic in places, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, you love everything.
Yeah.
And you're incredibly kind and indulgent to this crazy mixed up kid. This is a troubled child who was born of difficult circumstances. Some the other kids on the playground might find this child annoying and difficult, but Nick, you understand and you will take care of it. I now present to you God Only Knows. But as long as there are stars above you, you'll never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd do without you. What can I say about this one?
Musically is proficient. look, Okay, this
it
is where
it starts and ends with
this
everyone.
This is where I start everyone. Struggling. Look, okay. I think in my book, you know, which I first wrote, we're getting on for 25 years ago now, and I have updated it and revised it, and I haven't just revised facts. I have sometimes gone back and altered, because I, as is my prerogative, my opinions change. I have changed what I've said about things occasionally, and I think in my book I did give this one. We're talking about God Only Knows, the cover version of that classic Beach Boys song from Pet Sounds originally. And I did give it a bit of a savaging, Bowie's version of it. I think I probably monster this one track more than any other of Bowie's. And when I went back to listen to Tonight yesterday for the first time in a while, I did wonder whether maybe in my indulgent old age and knowing that we're going to do this podcast, maybe I'd soften a bit and maybe I'd think, oh, come on, it's, you know, to be sort of a grumpy old man. It's lovely, isn't it? And so I listened to it again. Oh dear. It is a bit lifeless, isn't it? This is the fact. It's, and you know, the croon, the Bowie croon, he's a great crooner. And sometimes if the croon is appropriate, I don't, you know, the croon is a weapon in his armory. But here it's just, it's just the whole thing feels sludgy to me, a sludgy arrangement, a sludgy tempo. And it's just, I'm struggling, as you can hear.
The day after Bowie died, Brian Wilson tweeted, "I was shocked to hear today about David Bowie. My thoughts and prayers go out to his family. I was honoured when David recorded God Only Knows." Now, Brian Wilson is one of pop's sweetest gentlemen.
Yeah.
And I think that sweetness was being sorely tested there, because you're right. Everything you've said is absolutely true. Now, one thing that you touch upon, which I think could be a key to unlocking this awful mystery, is the croon. Now, this is an Arif Mardin arrangements, the strings.
Yeah.
Don't they remind you of a Nelson Riddle arrangement at the beginning, and then the croon coming, and suddenly you're thinking very Sinatra.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's sounding like something
I wondered, I don't know what Nelson Riddle arrangement it particularly reminded me of, but I went back to various soundtrack albums and compilations, and it seems to be very much in that vein. You know, the beginning of it, and then the croon coming in. So that's maybe he went into
it. It almost feels
thinking.
Like something from an old movie, doesn't it? From
exactly.
Yeah, there's like, oh, here comes, you know, Gene Kelly's about to sing a number, or Frank Sinatra, or Dean Martin, or something. Yeah.
That could be maybe the mindset he had.
Of course, it's a song that he had tried before, about 10 years earlier. He had it penciled in for the Pinups album, which, of course, was an album of some of his favourites from the 60s. This song is 1966, isn't it? Pet Sounds, is that right? Yeah. And it was a hit, of course. It was a hit single. It was a song that everyone knew. And it's been covered by everybody and their dog, hasn't it? And it's one of those songs that I don't think I've ever heard a cover version. I've heard quite a few cover versions of God Only Knows. And it's a great song, by the way. It's obviously a brilliant, brilliant song. It's one of the songs where you just, you know, you can't take it away from the fact that, you know, the Beach Boys were sort of in kind of friendly competition with the Beatles at this time. Mm. And it is the song that absolutely stands up to anything that the Beatles ever did, I think. So there's all of that. And he did record it in 1973 with the Astronettes, which was, you know, his project with Ava Cherry and Jeff McCormack and some other protégés of his. And the Astronettes version has sort of, you know, turned up. Those things have been released. And that has Bowie playing saxophone and it has a Tony Visconti tree arrangement, so in some way it's kind of slightly more interesting to hear. If you should ever leave me, your life would still go on. Leave me. Well, could show nothing to me. So what good would live? The Astronauts version does actually sound very similar. It has the same sort of languorous tempo. It has, it's not, I think it's like, it's rough around the edges, because all of the Astronauts recordings are a bit rough around the edges. And I'm not sure that they ever really got mixed properly either, which is probably one of the reasons they sound a bit rough. It's funny. I mean, I don't think the Astronauts version is tremendously successful either, but it's very interesting to hear it. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be horrible about it, because it is still David Bowie, and it's still, you know, and I do love him, and I do, because I respect him greatly. I
just have to point out to listeners right now, Nick is looking more pained than I've ever seen him. We literally
I'm turning like a boar on a spit. I mean, but it's no, there's no getting
genuinely aggrieved.
Yeah, I'm genuinely, look, so you know what I'm saying is, I love this
track because it's David Bowie, but I don't like it very much.
It's like a middle child.
Exactly, exactly. It's like
I love you because you're my son. Yeah. I just don't like you very much.
That's exactly it. And there's, I mean, you know, because you said it's the arrangement in many ways sounds very retro and very sort of golden age of the Great American Songbook or something. But it also sounds very, very 80s, I think. I mean, there's an instrumental passage in the middle that's so painfully mid-80s that it starts sounding like the theme music from Howard's Way or something. Oh dear!
I'm not sort of held back by your innate decency. I mean, for me, I actually listened to it a few times before we spoke, just to make sure that I wasn't being unfair or, you know, I listened to it trying to find the good in it, and then I bathed my ears in the original, and they're in two different universes. When you listen to Introduction, it's Brian Wilson's music making in a nutshell. It is gentle. It is multi-layered, multifaceted. I think there's an accordion, French horn. There's, and we all know the great mental toll putting these tracks together exerted on Brian Wilson, but his fanatic determination to get to what he heard in his head. And it's just heavenly, this music. And then we begin with one of the most devastating couplets in pop. I may not always love you, but as long as there are stars above you, you know, and it goes, I mean, obviously Tony Asher wrote the words. Why does Bowie decide to ditch all this and begin with verse two?
Yes, he starts with, if you should ever leave me, doesn't he? That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Which is like puncturing. I mean, you know, not only as he mounts this track in a back alleyway, he's now kicking it repeatedly in the face. I mean, why would you lose that huge pivot, that emotional pivot, which comes about from this thing? There was a wonderful article I read recently about this song where the writer was positing that this was the trauma, confusion, euphoria, and fear of being a teenager in love for the first time.
Yes.
Encapsulated one song. I may not always love you, but, you know, the arrogance of the teenager saying, as long as there are stars above you, you know, our love will last forever. There's no way the universe can conspire against us. So Bowie, again, kind of goes clodhopping into this tune. Like you say, the arrangement is just a crime against humanity. It is absolutely unforgivable.
Yeah.
The guitar and, you know, these kind of lurches where the Beach Boys original gracefully
so light transition on its feet, isn't it? And yet so weighty. And so you know, proper in the right sort of way. And yet, Tony Asher, the lyricist, when asked to nominate a favorite cover of one of his Beach Boys songs, he said David Bowie's God Only Knows was his favorite cover version that he had heard of any of the Pet Sounds material. So there we go. There are going to be people out there who are, you know, cursing us and saying, "How you don't get it? It's brilliant. It's wonderful."
I would like to hear from these people. I will do a whole episode with one of these people if they'd
like to get in touch.
If they can articulate a defense for Bowie's God Only Knows. I mean, let's just look at the phrasing here. It's just demented. You know that you know, I'll make you so sure. You know, it's like a sort of drunken fight at 2 a.m. I know there are plenty of detractors about Across the Universe, for example, which I think has a certain rickety charm.
I don't get that at all. I love Bowie's Across the Universe, and that is a hill that I will die on, as we say these days.
I'll die alongside you on that hill.
Absolutely beautiful version, and I don't understand what people are talking about when they say it's crass and tasteless.
The Universe sound a masterpiece of understated emotion and empathy. You know, I don't know. It's like here, like throughout, there's it's relentless in its in its sheer horror. I mean, you know, like here, the middle the middle section, which again we say, you know, the Beach Boys are just sprightly and nimble. Here sounds like, you know, Bowie's trying to reverse a truck in a cul-de-sac. You know, it's got. Yeah. No grace. It's got no delicacy at all. Yeah. Awful. Awful. Sorry. I should stop here.
You're apoplectic with rage, aren't you? I can tell you.
Melting.
Well, look. The good news is we're past that one now, and I don't think it ever. Okay. Whatever else we think about the rest of this album, I don't think it ever. That's for me at least. That is the low point.
That is the low
by,
point.
By several fathoms, actually.
I don't think actually anywhere else in the back catalogue is there such a brutal misfire of a song.
Yeah. No, I pretty much agree, actually. It's just a sort of, you know, one that just didn't go off right. Interestingly enough, there's another track later on this album which Bowie himself clearly had it far more in for, which we'll come to, because I've got a quote about one of the other songs where he himself absolutely monsters one of his own recordings, but it wasn't this one.
And that was part one of my chat with Nick Pegg about Tonight. And part two is just around the corner, in the wings, getting its hat ready. We'll be with you shortly. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, and please do like, subscribe, share, review this podcast as you see fit. I'm looking forward to getting the next episode ready for you as soon as possible, but till then, don't look down,